This is Bob Brumby on Okinawa, less than 350 miles from the mainland of Japan. The sound and fury of the fighting on Okinawa has died away. Our flag waves defiantly over the island. After 82 days of bitter fighting by our armies, Navy, and Marines, magnificently supported by our air forces, as has been said, history will tell how far Japan lost the war on Guadalcanal, America won the war on Okinawa. This correspondent was not on Okinawa during the heavy fighting, the bitter night and day struggle. But here with us, at the microphone, a five top-flight veteran war correspondent who went through the Okinawa campaign, as they have gone through most of the hard-fought campaigns in the Pacific. They have kindly agreed to give an eyewitness account of the battle. And then have asked that the program be dedicated to the memory of Ernie Pyle, who died covering the Battle of Okinawa. In the order in which they will speak, they are Bill Lawrence of the New York Times, Al Dopkin of the Associated Press, Mac Johnson of the New York Herald Tribune, George McWilliams of the International News Service, and Wilson Annabelle of the United Press. It is dawn on Easter Sunday, April the 1st. A huge amount of ships lies rocking off the coral reefs of Okinawa. Landing craft surge towards the hostile shores. The Japs, surprisingly enough, give ground. There is little fighting during the first few days. Then the Japs brace, and one of the bitterest battles in history rages on land. While at sea, the deadly, subhuman, kamikaze suicide pilots dive on our ships. And here are the highlights of one of the most important victories in American history. The Battle of Sugarloaf Hill, as related by Bill Lawrence for the New York Times. No better illustration of the intensity of the battle for Okinawa can be found than the first fight for Sugarloaf Ridge. It was the hardest fought, costliest single engagement in Pacific War history, raging for 5 days and five nights with unabated fury. All casualties on Sugarloaf exceeded the number of counted enemy dead by 3-1. It is a chapter more or little fail to talk about when they recall the campaign that brought Japan to her knees. Of course it was costly. It had to be. For the Japanese soldier who fought here was a tough, well-trained, crafty foe. 10 times, infantrymen of the 6th Marine Division charged to the top of this tiny, ugly hill rising only 150 feet above the East China Sea. 10 times they were knocked off, pushed back by the Japs. Here as everywhere on Okinawa, the enemy fought from literally hundreds of caves, honeycombing all four sides at every height. They were mutually supporting, but when you approached one, you ran into murderous crossfire from several other openings. Tunnels running through Sugarloaf and connecting with nearby Half Moon Hill enabled the enemy to move his forces back and forth for the maximum effect. As the Marines drove to the top, cleaning out caves as they went, tunnels to occupy caves behind our men. Thus, when the Marines reached the top, they often had fire on them not only from the reverse slope of Sugarloaf and from the tops of nearby hills, but from the rear as well. The enemy was too close for artillery, naval gunfire, or air bombardment support. The enemy's terrain advantage made our medium tanks sitting ducks for his well-priced, powerful artillery, a fact borne out by the tank graveyard you can see today near the Esato River. So the men on foot had to do it alone. On May 18th, the Royal was driven to charge the hill again for the 11th time. This time, the Marines stayed there. Sugarloaf was ours, and the western anchor of the enemy's Naha, Shuri, Yonaburu line had been turned. After Bill Lawrence for the New York Times, here's a battle for Shuri Castle and Conical Hill, as related by Al Dopkin of the Associated Press. The enemy hold defense system was built around Shuri Castle, Bob, as you well know. And this ancient slang of the medieval king for the Ryukyus, the Japanese commanding general Ranishu, ran it through there. It took us exactly 40 days to cover 3 or 4 miles to get there. There never has been a battle like it in the Pacific. More than 200,000 rounds of artillery were thrown at this 500-foot plateau. Both it and its supporting chain of ridges were honeycombed with hundreds of caves, many of them wired with electricity and all cunningly raised by the net. This port will fall May the 29th, but the stars of battle still are there. The countryside is steeped in vegetation today. 12 wrecked American tanks and the stink of death are grim reminders of the bloody battle of Hot Isle Hall and mud and rain. It was only by one of the finest jobs of Army teamwork that Sherry ever saw. A black liability he had his, but he had part, but he could not be anywhere at the same time. Two things worried him as much as the frontal attack for the 77th Infantry Division. The attacks on Warner Ridge on the west and Conical Hill on the east, the two Sherry Castle anchors. Noble General Pedro de Valle's 1st Marine Division is attacking Warner Ridge, and Major General James Bradley's 86th Infantry Division, Conical Hill. On both, Americans fought foot by foot. At times, the fighting turned into tornado duels, bodies of both sides littered the slopes. Then Conical Hill fell. And in the murky deep pre-dawn hours of May the 22nd, Major General Archibald Arnold's crack 7th of the battle rained out. Moved out for rain mud. They slipped quietly through the narrow Yonaburu corridor along the east coast and threatened shore from its back door. The Japs pulled out, leaving behind only a shell of defense to sign the retreat of their battle home. The battle to begin fighting the Japs of Guadalcanal and has been at it ever since, saw his chance. One of his companies, led by Captain Julius Dusenberry, waited more than a mile of hip-deep mud for 2 hours and 35 minutes to take Sherry, Bob. Being a big Federal from Charlotte to North Carolina, he raised 1,000 bars of the Confederacy. The next morning, the valley rushed up the American flag. He took his flag bearers all day to get there through the mud. Out the hour of that game. Now the battle of our old crew, as related by Mac Johnson of the New York Herald Tribune. The battle for Oroku Peninsula can well be called the Battle of the Hollow Hills. The enemy's defenses were based on mutually supporting caves, natural caves and artificial holes and tunnels bored into both the forward and reserve slopes of every hill. Major General Lemuel Shepard's 6th Marine Division had to kill nearly 5,000 Japs to capture Oroku Peninsula, but it meant more than annihilating so many stubborn enemy troops. It meant capture of Naha Airfield and opening of Naha Harbor to American shipping. The Marines had been fighting for 65 days when the peninsula battle started, but not the Jap. His Oroku forces were built around 1,500 fresh infantry-trained naval personnel. They hadn't been hounded and beaten and decimated like some of the Jap army units, and they resisted fiercely to the death. The Japs wouldn't withdraw, so the Marines fought to the very mouth of every cave. They fought through interlocking Jap machine gun fire and constant mortar barrages. They seared caves with flamethrowers and sealed them with explosives. But it was tough and bloody. In one day, we lost 3 company commanders and a single regiment. Isolated on the peninsula, his troops dead or doomed, Admiral Minoru Oto, commandant of Okinawa's naval base force, slit his throat. 5 other high-ranking Japanese officers died with their admiral in the same bloody, self-inflicted manner. Unable to face adversity, they took their lives in the Admiral's elaborate underground command post. Besides Oroku, another great battle for Okinawa was fought and won. It was fought nearly every day for 82 days. It was the Navy's fight to protect its ships against enemy suicide planes, Japan's Special Suicide Attack Corps. It was the fight against Japan's Air Force. The American fleet won because Japan not only failed to stop the Okinawa operation, but even failed to interfere with it. The Navy took its greatest casualties of the war in repelling the attacks. We lost ships sunk and damaged, but the enemy lost 4,000 planes, a blow from which he may never recover. Thank you, Mac Johnson. Now the battle for Mabuna, as related by George McWilliams of the International News Service.
The war on Okinawa was over by the time the 7th Division reached the end of Mabuni Ridge, but you'd never know it from the savage scrap along a 200-foot rack rising from the seacoast like a battleship, its sheer prow jutting inland. In the knees of caves and crevices honeycombing the ridge, from a jumble of hellfire's boulders along the beach, in tall sawgrass and scrub pine across the flatland, hundreds of Japs defended the isolated pocket as though they still held the whole island. On the crest were men of Colonel Mickey Finn's 42nd Regiment who took the ridge. On shore battered ledges below were the bodies of Japs who didn't think they could do it. It was a vicious 3-day fight, the 3rd day as tough as the 1st. Days after organized resistance ended June 21st, Yank babies were being killed and wounded on Mabuni Ridge, but the enemy paid an even higher price. Pops still alive on the ridge were wiped out with flame-throwing tanks and dynamite charges. Captain Dusty Farnham of Stillwater, Minnesota, brought a demolition team from cave to cave, methodically entombing Japs. Every time he dropped a charge into one crevice, a Jap hiding below would pinch off the fuse. Okay, said Dusty, if that's the way he wants it. He turned to one of his men. Toss a couple of smoke bombs in with the next charge. By the time the Nip can see the fuse, the whole thing will blow up in his face. The next charge nearly tore the top off the ridge. Not all the Japs on Mabuni fought to the last. In 24 hours, the 7th Division alone took 1,000 prisoners. We saw one group of 23, led in by two Jap captains. Weary, dejected, beaten, they were fairly sick of it all. They looked like they finally realized Japan has not only lost Okinawa, she has lost the war. Thank you, George McWilliams.
Standing by.
I saw the paratroop landing at a ferry.
The landing that cut off
the last remaining escape route of the Japs now trapped in Cagayan Valley. Took the Nip's last Luzon seaport away from him. Cost him his last airstrip on Luzon. And marks the beginning of the end of organized resistance on this island. It was at a ferry on 10 December 1941 that the Nip first landed in the Philippines. He landed there to assure an air base from which he could cover, with land-based planes, his later landing in force at Lingayen. Now that particular score has been settled with the enemy. He landed from the sea against little opposition. Our forces landed from the air with no opposition. 4 days before the paradrop occurred, bombers of the 309th Air Wing had pounded the area, making the position untenable for the Japs. He had withdrawn from the beach in the airstrip, back some 9,000 yards into low-lying foothills. 2 days before the drop, Connolly's guerrillas had surprise-raided the area to assure that no Jap strongholds remained near Camarengan Airstrip, where the 11th Airborne Paratroops were to drop. To further assure a successful operation, Mitchell bombers were out early on D-Day for their final airstrike. And just before H hour, other Mitchells laid a perfect smoke screen, which prevented the enemy from seeing what was to happen and to further demoralize him. In order to see the whole show, I thumbed a ride on a C-47 that had been provided for Army photographers. But it was not an exclusive because one other war correspondent also wangled a ride on this special plane. So we shared honors and pooled notes. We took off last from the departure field and then raced northward to be first over the target. We saw powerful C-46 transport planes take off, towing for the first time in a Philippine combat mission, gliders. Then came scores of C-47s carrying 24 paratroops each, more C-46s carrying 36 men, both doors removed so that men could drop from both sides of the plane simultaneously, also a first in the Southwest Pacific area. Then came transports carrying artillery and other necessary equipment. And every 30 seconds, the transport would take off. I lost count. But as I stood at the side of the runway, stopwatch in hand, fighting the wind and dust in the backwash of those stops, I thought how much a takeoff from this particular airfield must mean to these particular men. Men of the 11th Airborne and men of the 317th Troop Carrier Wing. It was from this field that on 6 December last year, Japs had taken off to attack Brown Airfield in Leyte. Next day, these same American soldiers had annihilated those Jap paratroops. Now, these same Americans were taking off from the same field to attack more Japs south of Apache. Poetic justice for these tough, seasoned GIs. Well, we arrived at the target a few seconds before the first transport planes arrived. In a few seconds, however, the sky was alive with planes and men. Above us, perhaps at 2,000 feet, flew T-38. Umbrella coverage to knock out any Jap who might have ideas about trying to interfere with the mission. A little below the 38, several Mitchell bombers were circling. Some of them had just laid that smoke screen which shielded the operation. Others were there, I think, to deliver any needed strikes if the enemy chose to resist. He didn't. We were below the bombers at about 1,000 feet, and several Piper Cubs were in our air lane. They had hopped over from nearby American Hill strips to watch the show. We were circling the target, doors open, windows out, hanging on to litter supports to keep from being thrown out of the plane. Those handling cameras near the open doors had been tied into the plane. All of our eyes were on those C-47 transports of the 317th Troop Carrier Group, Lieutenant Colonel Lackey's Jungle Skippers, men who made the first airborne show of the Pacific War when they flew the 32nd Division into action at Brunus, men who had flown 31 months and 30 million miles, 6 trips to the moon and back. The Jungle Skippers had carried the 11th Airborne to their jump on Tagaytay Ridge on February 3rd this year, after which the 11th had force-marched 35 miles in 36 hours to come within attacking distance of Manila from the south. The Jungle Skippers had flown men of this same 11th Airborne Division to their Los Baños jump on February 22nd, when they had helped in the rescue of 2,200 civilian Americans and Allied nationals. This was their third tactical mission with the 11th, and the 11th's third combat jump on Luzon. Our eyes were glued on those Jungle Skippers because men were going to begin dropping at the rate of nearly one man every second. At exactly 9:10, the show began. Suddenly, the sky was filled with little streaks that looked like exclamation points. Little green dots. Those were the men of the 11th Airborne. And above the little green dots, long streamers dangled, suddenly burst open and became full-blown parachutes. Within seconds, the air was filled with chutes. Transports came over the targets, 110 miles an hour, 500 feet altitude, dropped their precious cargo of American paratroopers, flew on to be replaced by another transport and yet another. It takes approximately 20 seconds for a man to drop some 700 feet in a parachute. Well, soon, those white and colored mushrooms began collapsing on the ground. The men had landed safely, and yet still more and more mushrooms were opening in the sky. And while all this was going on, not an enemy shot was heard. The Air Force and the guerrillas had done a perfect job of preparing for D-Day. Suddenly, there came an interval of about 5 minutes. During that time, I saw the men pick themselves up, get out of their harness, pick up their equipment, clear the field for the next wave. And the next wave of Jungle Skippers brought pararacks, 75-millimeter howitzers, and men of Lieutenant Colonel Henry Burgess's parachute field artillery, the Gypsy Task Force. Engineers and medics also dropped in this second wave. Engineers airborne, whose job it was to get airstrips in condition for use by American planes as soon as possible, and medics to give immediate attention to casualties. Well, there must always be some casuals when hundreds of men drop from 700 feet. When this wave was over, came another short pause. Then the gliders came in. This was the first time gliders had been used in the Southwest Pacific, and Colonel Snatch DuPont was keenly interested in watching this first tactical operation. He must have been well satisfied. C-46s of Brigadier General Paul Prentice's 433rd Air Transport Group came in at 500 feet. Behind each transport, a long cable stretched, and at the end of the cable was fastened either a CG-4A or a CG-13 glider. In these gliders, besides pilot and co-pilot, were jeeps, radio equipment, vital items for communication and transportation. Upon nearing the landing strip, the gliders cut loose, floated in on their own. The first glider came in, a perfect landing. It ran almost the entire length of that treacherous strip. Stopped just in time. By that time, the second glider was on the strip. It rolled up, stopped alongside the first. Glider after glider came in, and in spite of soft, grass-covered, bomb-pitted, shell-pocked terrain, each glider made an excellent landing, coasted up, joined the formation. The wheels of a heavy CG-13 were buried in the mud. The CG-13 carried some 15,000 pounds of cargo, and the weight had dug it into the soft soil. It was a little out of line, stopped too soon, its belly dragging the ground. But otherwise, those gliders gave the appearance of so many GIs lined up for close-order drill. Well, that completed the actual landing of men and their equipment, but we wanted to see what happened next, asked our pilot to circle the field some more. And we watched the men below us gather in small groups, watched the artillerymen busily assembling their 75s. They were facing south and ready to fire within 20 minutes. And we watched the medics rushing around below us, looking for casuals, administering first aid, signaling for jeeps that were already darting around wherever needed. The paratroopers split into three groups. One group advanced northward toward the town of Aperi to secure the town and seize the nearby airstrip. Another group moved northward, looking for Japs who might be lurking in that direction. A larger group moved southward, toward a third airstrip and toward the enemy. Japs of the 103rd Imperial Infantry Division who had not yet been engaged in action. Our plane circled over the target for nearly an hour so that we might see this following dispersal of our troops. But the actual mission had been accomplished in less than 30 minutes. Paratroopers and all their fighting gear, artillerymen and their guns, engineers and their tools, medics and gear, radiomen and their communication equipment, jeeps and their drivers, all these had been landed from the air in less than 30 minutes. There were casualties, yes. There must always be some casualties in such operations. A few men suffered broken bones and sprains, but at the initial cost of a handful of casualties, the men of General MacArthur's command had sealed the Nip's last chance to escape from Luzon, seized his last operational airstrip on Luzon, taken his last port of supply, all reinforcement, and all this happened within 250 miles of Formosa. This is Don Bell reporting from Manila. I now return you to Mutual in the United States.